Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today about repugnance. An economist tracks how things that make consumers go yuck affect the marketplace. But first, 9 Americans who worked on projects in Iraq for the contractor Kellogg, Brown & Root are suing that company in a case that will test the question, how does KBR's use of offshore shell companies to hire workers impact the workers' right to sue? The plaintiffs in the lawsuit claim that in 2003, KBR knowingly exposed them to a toxic chemical that increases their risk of getting cancer down the road. Farrah Stockman is foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. You might remember she broke the story of these offshore shell companies, and she joins us now to talk about the lawsuit. Farrah, you write, KBR first told these contract workers this chemical was just a mild irritant. What were the workers doing in Iraq, and what was the chemical they were exposed to?
These workers were sent to Iraq to repair a water injection plant that was part of Iraq's oil infrastructure, but the plant had been looted and it was covered with sodium dichromate, which contains a toxic form of chromium that causes cancer and other illnesses.
Well, and it was in piles of orange sand all around the plant. It was very visible.
Yes, it was all over. It was all over outside the plant as well, and workers got it on themselves every day that they were there.
We should say more than 100 Iraqi workers were also exposed to this chemical, eating their lunch right near it. You spoke to some of the Americans suing KBR. What kind of health problems are they having?
They talked of problems like nosebleeds, shortness of breath, problems with their mucous membranes, eye problems. Those were the kinds of issues that they described to me.
Well, you write that KBR is basing its argument against the lawsuit on an old World War II era law, something called the Defense Base Act. How does KBR believe that law protects them?
That law mandates companies buy insurance to give medical care, death benefits, and disability pay to its employees. But the flip side of it is that you can't get more than that. So under that law, even if your employer is negligent, even if they send you into harm's way or put profits over your safety, you can't easily sue them for a wrongful death or pain and suffering or additional damages.
By the way, this is, as we said, an old law created during World War II. What's the thinking about the law?
Advocates for the workers say that this law is outdated. It was passed at a time when nobody envisioned tens of thousands of contractors working in a battlefield, working in a war zone. Some of the advocates for the workers say the law should be updated so that companies who are negligent in this extraordinarily dangerous situation should be held accountable.
Well, here's where the sticking point comes, because as you reported earlier, KBR hired these workers through 2 subsidiaries based in the Cayman Islands, 2 subcontractors. In doing this, KBR avoided paying hundreds of millions of dollars in Social Security and Medicare taxes. So KBR had previously claimed that these were not directly their employees, but they were a third party. Doesn't that give the workers an opening to sue KBR?
Yeah, it's very ironic. I mean, when it comes to paying taxes for these guys, KBR says they're not our employees. But when it comes to getting the protections that an employer gets under the Defense Base Act, they say, hey, these guys should be considered our employees and they should not be allowed to sue us.
What's the thinking, though? I mean, as this debate goes on, what's the thinking as to whether or not these workers have a case?
I think it's uncharted territory. Interestingly, Blackwater is in a similar position. They hire their contractors as independent contractors, so they also don't claim them as employees for tax reasons. And now some Blackwater guys are also using this argument to try to sue. So it's really uncharted territory. We're going to see if it works. You know, it may not work.
Well, and as you write, fewer than 10 high-profile lawsuits have been filed against contractors in Iraq, and so far none of them has been decided in favor of the workers.
It's a tough road to hoe for them.
Meanwhile, Farrah, what's been the reaction in Congress to your reporting on the fact that KBR is hiring workers through subsidiaries, shell companies in the Cayman Islands?
There's been a lot of reaction. Senator Kennedy and Senator Obama introduced a bill that would stop federal contractors from using this practice, and I imagine there's going to be a fight against that from people who want to be able to do it.
Farrah Stockman, foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. Farrah, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
analysts disagree on whether or not the U.S. is in a recession, but consumers think it is. That's one reason consumer confidence has sunk to a five-year low, according to a new report out today. To boost consumer confidence, some lawmakers are arguing for more oversight of the loan and investment banking industries that produced the housing crisis. Others are arguing that regulation will stifle the free market. Well, Harvard economist and business professor Alvin Roth says free markets aren't entirely free. We haven't really accounted for the ways in which what can be bought and sold is set by repugnance. Repugnance. Take horse meat, for instance. It's illegal to eat horses in California, but it's perfectly legal to make it into pet food or export it to other countries for them to eat. Why? Repugnance. Alvin Roth spoke on a panel about repugnance and the economy at the American Enterprise Institute this past winter, and we asked him to tell us more about how things that make us go, ew, affect the economy. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first, let's start with the word itself. I say ew, ich. What do you mean by repugnance?
Well, I mean something a little different than that, although it has to do with that. I try to distinguish repugnance from disgust. And the way I think about it is there's a law against eating horses in California, against selling them in restaurants, but no law against eating cockroaches. And that's because eating cockroaches is disgusting. No one wants to eat cockroaches. So repugnance has to do with things that some people don't want other people to do. At least that's the way I'm using it.
I see. The thought of someone doing it. Even though there might be some people who want to. And that's the point, that around the world there are people, and this is a horrifying thought to me, a repugnant thought to me, but around the world there are people who do eat horses.
There are indeed. When you search for horse meat on the internet, you find sites saying that you shouldn't eat horses and you find recipes.
Well, let's get a little closer to this, something you don't want to hear of someone else doing. Is that about, you know, the restrictions then? Restrictions are put in place so that someone else can't do it?
Well, for a long time, for instance, for hundreds of years in Western Europe in the Middle Ages, it was not allowed to charge interest on loans. That was something that was repugnant. Now, of course, today you put your money in a bank and you get interest and they lend it out at interest, and that's the basis of a lot of our financial system.
Why was it repugnant?
People somehow thought that you shouldn't draw profit from capital. I don't know exactly why it was repugnant. One of the things I talk about when I study repugnance is that often it's difficult to tell what is repugnant and what isn't, and those things change over time and they're different in different places. So I think that probably the Catholic Church played a big role in fostering the repugnance of lending money for interest. And today in the Islamic world, there's still a widespread feeling that charging interest per se is not a good thing.
Yeah, see, so it ripples its way through cultures. And I think I read in an essay of yours in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, and we'll link to that on our website, that at one time the same repugnance was felt about life insurance.
Yes. So there's a sociologist named Viviana Zelizar who studied life insurance in the United States. And in the 1800s, when life insurance started to be introduced, people would say to you, "So you want to put a price on your life, and then you want to bet with me about when you're going to die? Don't you understand that some things can't be priced?"
That's repugnant.
Absolutely. Right. But today we feel very differently about that. If you're about to have a child, you'd better have life insurance. That's just part of being a responsible adult.
Give us some other comparisons of things that are allowed and not thought to be repugnant and things that are not allowed, barred from the marketplace, and are thought to be repugnant.
Well, dwarf tossing. There's a sport in which some dwarves earn their living being thrown for distance, and in many places it's against the law. There's another sport that we have a North American championship near here in Boston called wife carrying, which no one seems to object to, but it's very hard to tell the difference to me why one should be repugnant and the other not. They both involve a big person and a small person, and the small person's chief attribute is smallness.
And if anyone's seen the wife carrying contest, it's not fun for the wife. She gets wrapped around people and dragged through mud, and yet the market has decided in some areas that one is okay, one is not, even though there might be dwarfs who say, you know, I don't mind this, I want to do this.
Yes, indeed. There's when dwarf tossing became illegal in France, a French dwarf appealed his way all the way up to the Conseil d'Etat, the Supreme Court, and after losing went to the UN High Commission on Human Rights, claiming that his right to employment had been violated. And France, in its case before the UN, said that the the EU Convention on Human Rights allowed them to make laws that preserved human dignity, and this was such a case. And the French dwarf had a very moving statement. He said, "There aren't any jobs for dwarves in France, and the essence of human dignity is having a job, and this is my job." And when I read that, I thought that he was going to win, but in fact he lost. The UN found for France that when he earned his living this way, it diminished our human dignity. So they found it repugnant.
We also read that Ontario has a dwarf throwing ban as well. Well, this is just so fascinating. So you've been on panels, you've written papers. This is much discussed in your world. Why? How do companies then use this information?
Well, sometimes companies propose things that people find repugnant. So there was a time when the Coca-Cola company thought of instrumenting some of its vending machines so that they would charge different prices based on the temperature and charge more for Coke when the weather was warm. And this received a terrible reaction and never was put into practice because people found it repugnant.
That is where repugnant is really differentiated from disgusting. It would bother someone as opposed to disgust them.
Amazon at some point tried to price things differently depending on your history on Amazon. But instead of saying they gave frequent users discounts, they wanted to give new users discounts, which meant that when you signed on, they might charge you more based on the fact that you were a frequent customer, and people didn't like that.
And so quickly the marketplace lets the market know.
Well, sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes there are missing markets or markets that don't exist, not because of something that happens in the marketplace, but because legislation is passed, for instance. So I have no idea how much horse meat was sold in restaurants in California before the law. Incidentally, it's not an old Wild West law from the time when a horse was a man's best friend. It's a 1998 referendum that was voted for by more than 4 million people, more than, you know, around as many as voted for Gray Davis for governor.
Huh. Missing markets. That brings us to, we understand you are in an area called market design, setting up markets that didn't exist before. Explain that.
Well, the easiest way to think about it is in terms of kidneys. It's illegal in the United States to buy or sell kidneys for transplantation, but there are lots of people who would like to give a kidney to someone they love. The biggest source of kidney donation is live donor kidneys these days, because you have two kidneys, and if you're as healthy as you look, you could stay healthy with just one kidney. So it might be that you wanted to give a kidney to someone who you love, and you're healthy enough to do it, but you still can't, maybe because you have incompatible blood types or for some other reason. And it might be that I'm in the same situation. So one of the things we've helped set up here in New England is called the New England Program for Kidney Exchange, which would allow me to give a kidney to the person you love and you to give a kidney to the person I love.
Uh-huh.
And one reason why these things are important is that it's illegal in the United States to buy or sell a kidney for transplantation. So putting money into the equation is something that people find repugnant. But trading kidneys in kind is not repugnant.
That's Harvard economist Alvin Roth on the economics of repugnance. Of course, all of this raises so many other questions. For instance, what about other transactions? What about paying a mother for her child? Why is that repugnant? But you can buy reproductive services from someone. So we're going to ask those questions. Also later today, China's control of Tibet is repugnant to many Westerners. So why are the Chinese so puzzled by that? Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more of our conversation with Harvard economist Alvin Roth on repugnance and the marketplace. And, Professor, you were describing the kidney market you've set up. It's an exchange, let's say two couples, a donor and recipient, and each can decide to swap the kidneys of the donors for a better match. No money is exchanged. But Sally Satel is quoted in the New York Times, and she would take it further. She asks, why can't we pay for kidneys? Why is it that a fireman is allowed to risk his life and be paid for it, but a kidney donor is not allowed to risk their life and be paid for it?
It's an excellent question, and I think that's what makes the study of repugnance so interesting, is that it's very hard to say which things we find repugnant and which are not. But certainly there are many things that are not widely thought to be repugnant that if you add money to them become repugnant. So, for example, imagine that you invite me to dinner at your house, and after a nice dinner, I reach into my pocket and pull out my wallet and I say, that was a splendid dinner. That would have cost at least $50 at a nice restaurant. Let me pay you $50. Well, you'd never invite me back to dinner. On the other hand, if I brought a $50 bottle of wine to the dinner, that wouldn't be repugnant. That would be received with gratitude. If I said to you after dinner, you know, you really must come to dinner at my house sometime, that would seem perfectly appropriate. So there are lots of things I can do in response to having a nice dinner at your house, but paying you money is not one of them.
How are people, if they are, trying to overcome repugnance? I mean, do businesses, do surveys realize something is repugnant and then try to change values? Is that part of understanding what's repugnant?
Well, I think that sometimes repugnance changes over time and with education and what psychologists call framing. So if you think about the life insurance industry, they had to explain how buying life insurance was part of being a responsible person and that you were not betting on your life. You were securing your family's sustenance. And when you start thinking about insurance that way, it doesn't seem as repugnant as taking bets on whether you're going to live or die.
I'm just curious, what are some of the other markets, these missing markets that are missing in large part because people found them repugnant in certain ways? And you're in the business of designing a market, much like the Kidney Exchange Program. What are some of the other markets that you're designing?
Well, so most of the markets that I'm designing don't need design because of repugnance. They need design because of other ways that markets can fail. So I'm involved in designing lots of labor markets, professional labor markets. So, for instance, most doctors in the United States get their first jobs through a program called the National Resident Matching Program, which is a centralized clearinghouse for new doctors. So, for example, we just helped gastroenterologists redesign their labor market. And part of the problem they were having was that some employers made very early offers before other employers could have a chance to take a look at the candidates. And the question was, if someone received a very early offer, would it be okay if he changed his mind later? And eventually the gastroenterology associations adopted a policy that said it would be okay if people could change their mind from, you know, turn down very early offers that they'd accepted. And this solved the problem. This stopped people from making very early offers. But there was some question about would it be repugnant to turn down an offer that you had accepted, even if this would help solve a big problem the market was having. Mm-hmm.
Well, we weren't even aware of repugnance before, and now it's everywhere we look. We hear of, economists saying, quoting Aristotle, in fact, saying that repugnance makes a necessary contribution to the good life, especially when there's not time for intellectual evaluation. In other words, it's just when you go with your gut, I guess. Steven Pinker says that repugnance is morality's early warning system. Do you see repugnance as a good thing?
I think that there might be occasions when it's an early warning system if you have to make a very fast decision. I don't think that that kind of early warning system is necessarily the best basis on which to make legislation.
Well, and what do you think you see? I don't know if you look at the future of repugnance, but what do you see on the horizon that might be repugnant now that you predict won't be?
Well, think about globalization. We've seen markets get increasingly large, and also more and more things are part of the market that used to be, say, home production. So we are willing to have someone come and clean our house, and we can pay for that. We're willing to have take out food, so we can pay for that. We're willing to hire people who help take care of our children, and we can pay for that. And my guess is that not too long ago, those were things you should do yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first McDonald's coming to our neighborhood, and my mother treated it as if it was some sort of, heathen place. You know, go somewhere else but home to eat? Couldn't conceive of it.
Right. So my guess is those trends will continue. To take an example, I don't know that there's a trend in which way this is going, but to take an example of a market that's illegal in many places but legal in many others, think about prostitution. Right? There's a market that many people find quite repugnant. On the other hand, there are places in the world, including places in the United States, counties in Nevada, where it's legal to be a prostitute and to organize a brothel. So that's certainly a case where ideas about repugnance may be in flux.
Adoption. Just comment on that because, of course, there's a ban now on people directly selling their children to a buyer. But some would say, what's the difference if you're going to China, for instance, and paying a lot of money right. for a child?
You can certainly pay a lot of money if you want to adopt a child, but what you're not allowed to do is buy the child from the birth mother. So the birth mother is not supposed to receive money in exchange for the child because, in part, we find that repugnant. We don't like to think of children being sold.
Right. We don't like to think of poor parents being pressured to sell their children, things like that.
Right. On the other hand, just in that same domain, you can buy a lot of reproductive services. So you could buy the services of a surrogate mother to bring to term a fertilized egg. You could have someone be pregnant for you. So I find it very difficult to predict what is repugnant and what is not.
But we do know that has changed. That yes. world has changed.
Yes.
Well, it's fascinating. Alvin Roth, professor of business and economics at Harvard University, for his essay, Repugnance as a Constraint on Markets. Go to our website, here-now.org. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, looking for a mortgage. A lender tells us you're going to need more of a down payment than ever. And even then, banks are wary of buyers with great credit looking at houses with overinflated prices. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Laurie Anderson will be here with her new music. After the news, Here and Now. French President Nicolas Sarkozy said today that he can't rule out boycotting the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics this summer. Sarkozy says he's waiting to see how the unrest in Tibet plays out. Well, International Olympic Committee President Jacques Roga is keeping mum on the subject. He's engaged in what he calls silent diplomacy with China on Tibet and other human rights issues, although he does say there are no plans to change the route of the Olympic torch, despite the most intense pro-Tibet protests in almost two decades. The lighting of the torch was disrupted by protesters yesterday. The flame arrives in Beijing Monday. From there, it begins an odyssey that will take it through five continents, every part of China, through Tibet, to the summit of Mount Everest. Well, our next guest says each side in the reheated divide over Tibet needs to better understand the other side's thinking. John McAloon is an anthropologist and Olympic historian who teaches at the University of Chicago. He advised the Beijing Olympic Committee on the international part of the torch relay. He joins us now. Welcome, Professor.
Good to be with you.
And what kind of advice did the Chinese seek?
Well, it was a question when I was involved with the bid committee of planning an Olympic flame relay route that was attractive to the IOC members and interesting to the Chinese public. So this was, of course, some years ago before the present controversies arose, but everyone was very aware that the Tibet issue was likely to come to the fore as the relay approached.
And it has, and some other controversial things that have also popped up. The Chinese are taking the torch to the summit of Mount Everest. Already both China and Nepal saying they're going to prevent climbers from summiting in that month in May. And then Taiwan, which considers itself separate from China, but which China considers part of its territory. Is the torch going through Taiwan?
It will not at the present time. There was a failure to come to an agreement between the Taiwanese Olympic Committee and government and the Chinese organizers as to where the torch would come from to Taiwan and to where it would go afterwards. The Taiwanese feeling that they were being treated like a province of China rather than an independent country, the Chinese unwilling to compromise, so the torch will not make an appearance in Taiwan.
Well, now that's interesting to us because Taiwan could claim some victory there, you know, that it doesn't have to have the torch at all and the symbol of the Chinese Olympics.
Actually, the Taiwanese public opinion is quite the opposite. Now, we just came through elections in Taiwan, in which the more moderate candidate won, and there was a certain feeling that to miss this opportunity of having the Olympic flame itself was a very high cost to pay. On the other hand, of course, the politics of recognition and sovereignty are sacred to both sides, and the torch relay was a consequence that neither side wanted to compromise on.
Well, but, you know, that brings a question before we move on to others. Why did Taiwan get a say but Tibet not?
Tibet is not, in the Olympic world, Tibet is not an autonomous entity. Taiwan, Chinese Taipei, as it's known in Olympic circles, is represented independently as an autonomous country in the Olympic world. Mm-hmm. Tibet is, although of course it's a vexed question, mm-hmm. is a part of the territory of the People's Republic of China.
Mm-hmm. Professor, how would you characterize the internal debate in China, in government circles, over, you know, the Tibet issue and the increasing protests from Tibet?
Well, as we've begun to see in the last few days, there is a great deal of internal debate in China on this issue. We underestimate that often in the Western press. First of all, there are leaders in the hierarchy of the Chinese Communist Party, most notably, for example, Zhang Liang, which is the pseudonym of the ranking party official who leaked the Tiananmen Papers to the West some years ago, who very much feel that the Olympic events, the flame relay, the games themselves will trigger a continued debate and shore up the reformist forces within the party.
There are people who actually think that the Olympics and the torch relay and whatever debate is provoked will be a means for change.
Well, we see all around us, don't we, that the argument is worldwide at the moment, whether we're talking about heads of state, whether we're talking about the Olympic authorities, whether we're talking about the Chinese people. There was a demonstration several days ago of students from the University of Minorities in Beijing, unprecedented, calling for a change in the policy toward the autonomous regions. A large number of intellectuals in Beijing 2 days ago signed a petition calling for a rethinking of the policy and opening debate with the Dalai Lama, or conversations rather with the Dalai Lama. So there's a great deal of dissent in China on these issues, which is getting some attention and a stage because of the Olympic phenomenon.
Well, and do some people believe that the torch relay in particular might be the best opportunity for protest because it's outside of mainland China in so many ways?
Well, whereas there will be, there's no question, as we saw in ancient Olympia yesterday morning, we'll see again, for example, in this country when the flame comes to San Francisco on its one stop in the United States. There will doubtless be protests all along the route, pro-Tibetan protests. This is really nothing new. In 1992, for example, protests by Catalan independence forces mm-hmm. During the Barcelona torch relay. The flame attracts so much attention. It is the world's most important peace symbol. That attention is capital, is power. It attracts all sides to the pressing political questions in the territories through which it goes.
Well, we mentioned the government and internal debate in the government. What about the Chinese people? The government officials say the torch represents a journey of harmony. Mm-hmm. Tibetan protesters, as we know, say the torch is a symbol of Chinese expansion and oppression. As you say, Tibet is officially called the Tibet Autonomous Region, but historically it governed itself as a theocracy. And in 1959, the Dalai Lama, the spiritual and government leader, fled to India during a revolt against Chinese control. And since then, there's been the clampdown that we see. We got an email from one of our listeners, Jack Huang of Carleton, Massachusetts, after our coverage of the protests last week. And he writes from a point of view that many Americans don't often hear. He says he sympathized with the Tibetans, who, like people everywhere, have complaints about their government, but that the Chinese government was right to crack down because riots aren't the way to go, that ethnic Tibetans have long received special treatment such as exemptions from the mm-hmm. one-child policy that his people, the mm-hmm. Han Chinese, don't have. Tell us more.
Well, this is what we really need is, and this is what the Olympic Games are for, it's sport in the service of intercultural understanding, international education, and détente. We need more to appreciate the fact, as your emailer is suggesting, that the elites in China absolutely, sincerely believe that China saved Tibet from slavery to a, quote, medieval theocracy. Now, as outsiders, we may find that absurd. Certainly it is absurd. But that doesn't help us get around the fact that it is very, very sincerely believed because it has been taught through generations of Maoist education in the schools, and it doesn't help to simply see China's action toward Tibet is motivated simply by a kind of naked power grab. It won't go away, though, by simply wishing it away.
That's Professor John McAloon. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, this listener goes on to say the Tibetans are allowed to have lower scores for college admission. Billions of taxpayer money is invested every year in the infrastructure and social welfare of the Tibetan region. And as you said, he sees his people, the Han Chinese, mm-hmm. as saving the Tibetans. He says infant mortality in Tibet drops from the astounding 43% in the theocracy prior to 51 to 3.5% mm-hmm. in the year 2000. So he's expressing that view, that he feels that the mainland Chinese people have saved Tibet.
Absolutely. This is, as I say, a thoroughgoing and sincerely held belief. Of course, you'll notice that what is missing in what you've read from his comment is any concern with cultural genocide, which is the expression the Dalai Lama is using. The Tibetan forces, certainly the Dalai Lama, do not deny for a second the advantages of the development, although many critics would argue they don't reach as deeply to the Tibetan people as they do to the Han people who have immigrated into Tibet. But it's the issue of destruction of a cultural regime, and in particular of direct state interference in Buddhist affairs, that are the main points of criticism, both by the Dalai Lama and of the protesters last week. And as your writer suggests, this is not something that that many Chinese are prepared to understand.
Well, it's the old anthropological argument, isn't it? The people who feel that they are saving the people while other people see them as destroying the villages in order to save the people.
It's a form of internal colonialism and internal imperialism.
So what's
China is so sensitive historically to Western imperialism, that there's a kind of irony here that it can't help but understand outsiders who complain as, in effect, trying to reinstate China in a dependent colonialist position. And that's China's challenge, is to try to escape or move beyond that logic and understand the seriousness of world opinion with respect to Tibetan rights.
So, Professor, what do we do with this understanding of both sides, in particular, Americans who still will lean to the side of Tibet's being wiped out culturally by the Chinese? We have people like Mayor Gavin Newsom in San Francisco, who says he's accused of aiding and abetting China for allowing the torch to pass through the city. So how do people hold a belief, you know, about China's role, and what do we do
as the Olympics unfold? This is the whole point, again, of these Olympic performances. Remember, that's not the Olympic flame that anybody is attacking. The Olympic flame is this master international peace symbol, a symbol of precisely intercultural détente and understanding. And it's part of its function. This is all good. That is to say that more and more people are having these conversations because of the proximity of Olympic events. It's very hard to see how the cause of the Tibetans would be served if these games were in Toronto or in Osaka or in Paris. So it's precisely creating debate, creating thoughtfulness, creating understanding of where this is coming from, a deeper understanding, that is the service that the Olympics produce on the human rights front. And that's hard. It's difficult. It's not easy for anyone, but it's what's required for progress.
John McAloon, an anthropologist at the University of Chicago, who advised the Beijing Olympic Committee on the international portions of the Olympic torch relay. He's also author of the forthcoming book, Bearing Light, Flame Relays and the Struggle for the Olympic Movement. It's a recent history of the torch relay. Professor, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And a quick news note. Today, the Supreme Court ruled against President Bush in what's being called a rejection of presidential power in favor of states' rights that puts the president in opposition to his allies on the court. The case began when another court, the International Court of Justice, ruled that the convictions of several Mexicans on death row in the U.S. violated the Vienna Convention because the men were denied access to Mexican officials. The World Court ordered a new hearing, and President Bush ordered the state of Texas to reopen the case. case. Well, today, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, said the international court's decision cannot be forced upon the states by the president. We'll keep following that story. And in 1 minute, performance artist Laurie Anderson with her unique view of the United States. Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Oh, Superman.
That's Laurie Anderson's 1981 hit, Oh, Superman, from her landmark performance piece, United States. In 1989, a New York Times headline asked, "Will success spoil Laurie Anderson?" Meaning, will she be able to retain her bohemian, lower Manhattan, artistic self-possession despite her wider acclaim? Well, the answer, almost 20 years later, would appear to be, yes, she has.
If only I had the time.
Laurie Anderson is looking at America again through her new show, Homeland. It begins a multi-city tour this weekend. Laurie Anderson joins us from her studio in New York. Welcome.
Hey.
Homeland, what a great word. Homeland Security, we were thinking Edelweiss, you know, bless my homeland forever. But what do you mean by homeland?
Well, it's such a sweet term. I don't think it's ever been used in a sweet way here. It's always used in a super ironic way with lots of quotation marks around it. So it's the kind of word I really enjoy because it makes you feel a few different things at once. Edelweiss I hadn't thought about, but yeah that's pretty unpleasant.
Except I should say when he was singing Edelweiss, he was escaping the Nazis. So there is a sweetness there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'll take that.
But what are you saying with the piece and with the title?
Well, I started writing this one on the road, looking around at what was going on in this country, and it is, in a way, a sort of update to this thing that I wrote many years ago called United States, just because I think things have changed so deeply in this country since that point, and I thought, well, I'll give a try at another description.
Well, we read that there's an important line. I knew I had lost something, but I just couldn't put my finger on it.
Here's the story. I was working on a film in Japan. It was a film with a lot of little, like, visual fables and sort of short stories. And one of the short stories was this, about, you know, feeling like you've lost something. It wasn't really about the things you've lost, but it was like sometimes you just feel like, wow, I lost something. Was it my car keys? Was it my, what was it? You know, just the feeling. So the translator, the Japanese translator is talking to me, and she said, well, what's this story about? What did you lose? And I said, no, it's not about what I lost. It's the feeling of losing things. And then she said, well, when did you lose it? And then I realized that I wrote it when we began the invasion of Iraq, and that what I lost really was my country. I think a lot of Americans felt that way and still continue to, and this election in many ways is playing that out. You know, how do you feel about where you live and what we do?
Hmm. Well, there's a piece in Homeland. It's called Pictures and Things. The themes run from the gold standard to childhood obesity and asthma in just 40 seconds. Let's listen.
It started the day Nixon took the country off the gold standard and money became numbers just floating around out in cyberspace, reaching a whole new level of abstraction. Then, records disappeared. Then, record stores and phone booths. The streets became quiet because the children got sick, because they hardly ever moved. All the children were fat and sick, sneezing all the time, choking on the air.
What were you saying there?
It is kind of an exercise in the jump cut. Lots of little fragments of images. And it's a way of writing that I really, really enjoy doing now, rather than sort of like stories with beginnings and middles and ends. These word pictures that add up to sort of more like a feeling than a story. But it is, of course, a way to try to talk about how our homeland is not so much a physical place as, in a way, a mental place, as the physical things like banks and records and record stores and so on, and the things that become abstractions. And so how do you feel about being in a place that becomes so much that has become digitized? What kind of place is that that you live? Hmm. One of the reasons I'm an artist is because I can live in a sensual world. And the sort of trend to life on the net is not as satisfying to me. So I find myself doing projects that have nothing to do with digital stuff, you know, doing things that have scale, doing things outside.
Well, we know you were part of the team that helped create the opening ceremonies for the Athens Olympic Games, and we understand that part of Homeland was created through improvisations at the Acropolis.
Yeah, that was one of the most amazing places I've ever played. You know, and there's a story that begins Homeland that was from a little kind of a riff on a bit from a play by Aristophanes called The Birds. It's about before the world began, when there was no earth and there was no land. It was just birds flying around. Then one day something happens. There's this lark, and one day her father dies, and they panic because they don't know what to do with the body because there's no place to bury it because there's no earth. So a kind of particularly Greek problem, you know, when so many plays were written about how do you bury the parents, what do you do with the parents, you know, how do you honor the parents and so on. Finally, the lark has this idea and she decides to bury her father in the back of her own head. And so I sort of describe that as the beginning of memory. And that's how Homeland starts, with this feeling of groundlessness, you know, like there's no ground underneath your feet, you know. I kind of compare that to this theoretical world of information that we live in more and more.
And trying to get it out of your head. Let's listen to Shortfall from Homeland.
Concentration. Empty your mind. Let the rest of the world go by.
Lori, I'm just wondering, how much does your practice of Buddhism help you do that? You know, empty your mind.
I'm not very good at it. You know, my mind is like a kind of a mess, really. It's stuff moving through it all the time. I would love to have better control over it, but also as an artist, you know, it's kind of great to have a chaotic mind, and it's sort of interesting to have bad things happen to you too. I try not to so much control things as just to learn how to watch things and how to describe things.
Hmm. I'm just so surprised to hear you say that you are, you know, rejecting in some ways the internet and digitizing, and you want to move away from that, because I would have thought, oh, you know, Lori Anderson, this would have been her perfect playground. Because you are, you know, so in the forefront of electronics, inventing the tape bow violin in 1977, incorporating all these different electronic sounds, you know, changing your voice to sound so many different ways.
Well, I only say that because I, like everybody else, love it and hate it sort of equally. Yeah. And I'm so afraid because I love it that I'll get sucked into it and forget that there are other things to life than looking at that screen.
Yeah. One very last question. Your partner of 16 years, Lou Reed, we just always wondered, how does that work at home? I mean, do you lean over and say, you know, a little less bass and they'll walk on the wild side? And he, you know, he
yeah, he doesn't take to that too well.
No.
Less bass. He likes bass a lot. We help each other a lot, but, you know, it's, in a way, it's also like a couple of lawyers living together, you know, that you really understand what the other person is doing.
I read in an Australian magazine that you once said, he said to you, why don't you just simplify that piece and make it a little less Baroque?
Yeah.
And that just, it was like a big light bulb for you. So there is some give and take there.
Oh, he helps me a lot. He's helped me a lot on Homeland, especially. I would say there's more of a groove in this show than in the past, and that's probably due to Lou.
Performance artist Lori Anderson, her new show, Homeland, will be touring the U.S. and the world. World domination through October. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Lori Anderson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was fun. Thanks.